Underworld, Disc 20.
Chapter 5. October 25th, 1962. This was Thursday. They'd first felt the full impact of the danger on Monday evening, when the president addressed the nation on radio and television. On Tuesday, they were told that Soviet ships were en route to Cuba with missiles and warheads to add to the number already installed on the island. Wednesday was tense. On Wednesday, they found out that our naval blockade was in effect and that 14 Soviet ships were nearing the quarantine line. Now it was Thursday. On Thursday evening, as SAC bombers carrying thermonuclear weapons circled the Med or flew Arctic routes across Greenland or hugged the western borders of North America, people rode home from work with the radio on or the newspaper up in their eyes. And with darkness webbing down out of the broad and soaring sky over the lake, deeper into evening now, the night people were out, slipping past the bars and tonky clubs, mingling with tourists and conventioneers who were checking out the action. On the fringe streets, they sidestepped taxis on the prowl and veered around the traffic of negotiated vice, and they made their way to Rush Street, finally, where Mr. Kelly's stood, a big-name room in Chicago's bouncing night. Lenny Bruce came slouching down from the second-floor dressing room and walked a little bleary-eyed through the kitchen and out the swinging doors, where he did a sidle step onto the stage. A waiter with a tray said, "It's a human zoo out there tonight." 15 minutes into his act, Lenny took a condom out of his pocket and tried to fit it over his furrowed tongue. Then he tried to talk through it, or out of it. Finally, he dangled the item between his thumb and index finger, holding it away from his body, specimen-like. "It's a dead jellyfish that has the reflex power to deliver one last spasmic sting." "I can be arrested in 23 states for waving this thing in public." You're thinking, sure, in the Bible Belt. Actually, I'm safe in the Bible Belt because they don't know what this is. They put saran wrap on their dicks. He shook his hands, hallelujah, and took a stagger step back. "I swear I saw it in Time magazine. You get a box of saran wrap and you tear off as much as you need for your particular endowment." The word endowment got a bigger response than saran wrap or Time magazine. "Leftover meatloaf." He did his hipster crack-up laugh, bending from the waist like some Hasid at serious prayer. There were a few people in the audience, 2, 3, 4 people, going small and tight in their seats. "Saran wrap. It sounds interplanetary. Picture it. A little town somewhere in America. A housewife pins laundry on a line. White and Negro children play peacefully in a schoolyard. Apple pies are cooling on kitchen windowsills. Suddenly, a deathly stillness. People pause in mid-motion. A dog named Skipper hides under the porch steps. Then a blinding flash. It's a visit from outer space. Creatures from the planet Saran. They're very thin and sort of filmy-looking. They say to the leaders of Earth, 'Take this new material we've just invented and test it on yourselves, because, frankly, we're afraid to.'" Lenny's heavy lids began to lower slowly as he changed the scene. "It's a documented thing. Farm boys and ranch hands taking strips of saran wrap with them when they go on dates. There are teams of sociologists doing field work on this matter. Not to mention ad men on the Dow Chemical account, which is the company that makes the stuff. And they're looking to position their product as a food wrap and a scumbag. If only they could devise a diplomatic language. Ad biggies on Madison Avenue. 'Let's do a nice old country doctor in a lab coat, sitting in his rustic office, pulling saran wrap off the chicken sandwich his wife packed for his lunch, and he drapes the wrap absent-mindedly around his finger. Talking about freshness and protection. Maybe sneaking in a word about overpopulation. And the ad men get excited by the idea. 'Let's run it up the flagpole. Blah, blah, blah. It's nearly subliminal, dig?'" Lenny whirls and points at some phantom Confederate on the wings. In fact, there are no wings, just walls and doors. He tried to fit the condom over his tongue again. "Never underestimate the power of language. I carry a rubber with me at all times because I don't want to inseminate someone by schmoozing with her. Some innocent teenage girl asks for directions to State Street? Zap! A virgin birth! A small commotion in the middle of the room. Could be some walkouts, or maybe just a waiter and some noisy plates. The waiters are supposed to work quietly during performances, but this was a hungry bunch of trenchermen, who made a racket when they ate, gorging on sirloins, barbecued ribs, lobster tails, spaghetti, and chicken livers, and more or less thrashing their way through a Mr. Kelly's specialty, the Green Goddess salad. Lenny said, "Love me unconditionally or I die. These are the terms of our engagement." Kelly's was jam-packed tonight, well over the legal limit of 160, and they were sitting, standing, and stacked 10 deep at the fire exit. And they were loud. They bawled and lowed like beef on the hoof. Men on business trips with dilated veins throbbing at their temples. A group of touring usherettes from the far west, half expecting to encounter themselves in one of Lenny's bits. And look at the heavy-set men in big suits with star sapphires on their pinky fingers, in from the mobster suburbs with lapels so wide they do semaphores when the wind blows. And a table filled with developers chewing on Cuban cigars, a bachelor night on the town, and sophisticated women digging the weird insides of one man's psyche, and a couple of butterball college professors looking for some belly laughs, idea men from the humanistic enclave. And Hugh Hefner, and a cluster of Playboy models, aspiring centerfolds on leave from the mansion, tall, young, fair, and so flawlessly complexioned they seemed to be airbrushed, and Hef with his dirty, paternal smile steel-seamed around a briar pipe. Walkouts in progress. An old story, of course, on the Lenny Bruce circuit. Two women and a man offended by the sight of a guy sticking his tongue in a Trojan. Lenny spotted them, and fixed on the woman bringing up the rear. Big boned, let's say, and able-bodied. "Look who's splitting the scene. You know how that is, don't you? You can recognize her from the wanted posters. Joseph Mengele's head nurse, up from Argentina on a budget tour." Pause a beat. "She's doing the stockyards, the prisons, and the morgue." Pause a beat. "When she was still active, they called her Attila the Huness." Who else was in the room? Second City Comics, here to idolize the super sicko. Jazz writers and theater people. Some porco politicos and their rosary bead wives. They're here under the impression that Lenny's an Italian crooner whose real name runs to 11 syllables and carries a serious curse. Who else? A number of Cook County vice cops scattered through the room with notebooks and tape machines sucking up every arraignable word. Lenny was still hectoring the walkouts. "Make room! Make room! They got a flight to Buenos Aires in 10 minutes. Eichmann Air. The Stews wear striped pajamas." Those were the terms of Lenny's act. If you didn't like the bits he did, you were a mass murderer. Or you were the polio mother of the year, 1952. Or the subject of a brief improvised bit, which he now performed on the flashing light in airliner toilets, a recent obsession of his. "Return to seat, return to seat, return to seat." Lenny once had a 60-party walkout in New York, an entire Grey Line bus tour, just upped and fled. Angelo, the maitre d', looked at Lenny and said, "You gotta talk dirty. Who's gonna make up the tips, you fuck?" Lenny licked and rubbed the condom. He fingered it, twirled it, snapped it. "I just realized. This is what the 20th century feels like." Then he paused thoughtfully, appearing to remember something. He stuck the rubber in his pocket, absently. He was wearing the same Nehru jacket he'd sported in San Francisco, his Hindu statesman number, and the thing was rutted and crushed by now, resembling some wadded discard plucked from the gutter. He also wore a large medal on a chain, an accessory to the Nehru. You got the medal for wearing the jacket. Yes, he was remembering something heavy and dense. Despite his week-long anxiety over the missile crisis, the blackout at Basin Street West, the endless bulletins issuing from every surface in the landscape, a network ranging from TV monitors in airport boarding areas to blind newsies selling tabloids on street corners. Yes, whatever the level of Lenny's unease, the nuclear showdown had slipped his mind. Better believe it. Their ships are approaching our blockade. Lenny nodded. He stroked the mole on his cheek. He waggled his fingers and looked out over the mast heads humming autonomically in the low smoke. We're all gonna die! He said it four times total, passionately high-pitched, arms flung up. And you're beginning to take it personally, he said. How can they justify the inconvenience of a war that's gonna break out over the weekend? He had it all planned. Friday night. Movie with your highbrow art film friends. Serious Swedish flick at the little theater near the university. Ursula Andress, naked to the waist with a slain calf slung over her shoulder. Saturday morning, let's see, dry cleaner, post office, grocery store, pick up shoes, put cat to sleep, call mom back home in French Lick. Yeah, I'm fine, how are you? Yada, yada, yada. Got a big date tonight with a real nice girl, Raytheon. She's a Mormon. They don't drink tap water or play the saxophone. Lenny broke off unexpectedly and leaned into the face of one of the real estate barons sitting ringside, a guy with the bloated cheeks of a trumpet player doing a cardiac solo. Mick Spick, hunky junky boogie. There was no context for the line except the one that Lenny took with him everywhere, the culture and its loaded words. He looked around some more. He seemed to need a particular kind of face in which to deliver his scripture. One of the college profs smiled invitingly, and Lenny obliged with, "Fuck, suck, fag, hag, give me a nickel bag." In fact, the words were thrilling. Many people had never heard these words spoken before an audience, by a guy in a Hindu tunic yet. And there was an odd turn of truth, a sense of unleashing, perhaps, or disembarrassment. Lenny followed this flurry with an erudite riff on the German word Sprachgefühl, a feel for language, for what is idiomatically hip. He reads up on things like this in hotels and on planes and back home in the smoky dawn of L.A. while he's waiting for a woman or a pusher. A fight broke out in the middle of his commentary, back near the fire exit. Five burly men and a fur ball of pommel and shove. Lenny egged them on, insulting their mothers, until they more or less rolled out the door. He remembered the crisis again. Yeah, so you pick up your date at the pad she shares with six other Mormon chicks. Wow, what a schizoid circus. They have strange, shiny eyes and a superhuman blondness. They're the next stage of evolution after Olympic swimmers. They're right at the edge of science fiction, man. Human lookalikes from space waiting for a signal to take over the planet. They think tap water's a government plot. Their water's trucked in from a well in Utah. Raytheon's kind of cute, but she's dressed so primly you feel your balls contract. You look at these girls and you mourn the lost glamour of women's undergarments. The whole Nazified system of straps and harnesses. It's a legal outlet for your secret fascist longings. But chicks don't buy into it anymore. All that slithery hardware that makes wars worth fighting. You take her to a funky down-home place near the women's house of detention. She orders a knuckle sandwich. Hey, the chick digs soul food. Your spirits soar. You think of the setup at your place. Bottle of VAT 69, zigzag cigarette paper, little baggie of dope from the high Andes. The mood lighting, the cool jazz on the turntable will do miles, yeah, from his blue period. If Miles can't soften her up, she's probably a diesel dyke. You're thinking all the universal things men have always thought about and said to each other. Get in their pants. Did you get in? Did you get some? Did you make it? How far'd you get? How far'd she go? Is she an easy lay? Is she a good hump? Is she a piece? Did you get a piece? It's like the language of yard goods. It's like piece goods. You can make her. She can be made. It's like a garment factory. It's like work that's paid for according to the number of units turned out. He's a make-out artist. She's a piece. Knock off a piece. It's a knockoff. You can't tell the woman from the fabric she's wearing. This is Lenny in his primitive Christian mode, doing offbeat sermons to desert rabble. You hail a cab, and the radio's on. Khrushchev wrote a letter to Kennedy. He wants a summit. Who is this Khrushchev, anyway? He's a starker in a bad suit. You're worried about your summit, not his. The whole point of the missile crisis is the sexual opportunity it offers. You get Raytheon to your place and convince her the whole world's about to go Zippo, and astonishingly it works. And within minutes she's standing naked in your living room, and she is all ovals and loops, like the Palmer handwriting method, and so blonde she could be radioactive. Lenny switched abruptly to ad-lib bits, whatever zoomed across his brain pad. He did bits he got bored with 5 seconds in. He did psychoanalysis, personal reminiscence. He did voices and accents, grandmotherly groans, scenes from prison movies. And he finally closed the show with a monologue that had a kind of abridged syntax, a thing without connectives. He was cooking free form, closer to music than speech, doing a spoken jazz in which a slang term generates a matching argot. Like musicians trading fours, the road band, the sideman's inner riff. And when the crowd dispersed, they took this rap mosaic with them into the strip joints and bars and late-night diners, the places where the Nighthawks congregate. And it was Lenny's own hard bop, his speeches to the people, that rode the broad Chicago night. July 2nd, 1959. We stopped the car half a block before the bridge and switched to a taxi. I gave the guy the address and he looked at me, looked at her, then nodded briefly. I was told it was better to take a taxi across the border, because if you drove your car, you became subject to major delays owing to inspections by customs agents on your return to the U.S. side for guns and drugs. The town had a strange electric brightness in the stormlight, blue and green stucco shops with pottery on display. Pottery, copper, blankets, glass. "I think I'm having second thoughts," I said. "Please, okay?" Maybe they're first thoughts. I never really thought hard enough until now. Amy could carry a fair amount of reproach in her clear brown eyes. "I took it for granted that this was the only thing to do," I said. "We should have talked about it some more." Her look was the kind of look you get when someone wants you to know she's taking great pains not to pity you. When we cleared the town and drove into the brown hills, the rain came hard. About 6 minutes later, the driver pulled up in front of a fairly sizable house behind some trees, and the sun was hot and bright, and the ground was smoking. The woman who let us in looked at Amy and said, "Please, your name?" More or less managerially. "Amy Brookhiser. Yes, you come with me." And that's what happened. Amy went with the woman, who was either the nurse, the wife, the office manager, or some combination of these. I thought we might have some reassuring words for each other, Amy and I, or I might say something even if she didn't, although I didn't know what I might say. But they were down the hall and making a left turn, and I still had our overnight bags in my hands. "All right." I set the bags down and went into the living room, or waiting room, and sat on the sofa. There were no magazines to read. All the reading was on the walls, painted sayings and occult symbols, and this was unexpected. Circles, chevrons, arrows, birds, mucho mystical drivel, and I was trying to absorb it all. A number of shaped sayings, words that formed triangles and tall palms, trees of life, perhaps. Sayings in English about the passage of the soul and the eye of God, and there were mystical eyes and admonitory hands on all four walls and the ceiling. I tried to absorb this surprise, wondering what it meant and why I hadn't been warned, and that's when the doctor walked in. A man I worked with in Palo Alto had given me his name and address, and I'd called and made arrangements. and there were assurances about safety from two other people I talked to. Safe, clean, professional. But no one had said anything about the walls. He didn't seem to be looking at me. He said, "Yes?" I said, "Dr. Swearingen?" He wasn't looking at me. He said, "Everything seems to be in order." I said, "Do I pay now?" We seemed to be having a conversation that went backwards. He thought about the question of payment, his mouth scrunched up, my hand at my wallet, waiting. He was a tall man in a white smock, tall and stooped, with an odd pallor, and deeply introspective, I thought. 6'7" or 6'8", an American who did abortions, according to the people I talked to, out of a sense of duty and compassion. And he hadn't shaved today. I paid him $200 cash, and he said, "Expect some bleeding." Maybe as a way of veiling the transaction. And then he went down the hall. I sat there with the pictures and the words. I didn't know how to think about any of this. I didn't know what to call it. Maybe Amy knew, but she wasn't saying much. All she wanted to do was get it over with. I was willing to make sacrifices and be responsible. This is what I told myself. I wanted to fix myself to something strong, to a wife, I thought, and child. But it wasn't strong at all. It was hopeless, worthless, and weak. We wouldn't last a month together. We were restless and grasping. We were a fling that had run intermittently for 2 years only because we lived in different cities. And we were religious in our attachment to risk. And she was the last thing I needed in this world. And you felt a strange, shaded grief, didn't you, sitting in the room? A sadness shaded by distance. And you tried to think yourself into the middle of the child's unlived life. Someone was cooking a meal a couple of rooms away, and this disturbed me. The savor of the food and the faint sounds of activity, someone opening cabinet doors, this disturbed and confused me, and made me a little angry. Amy was 26 years old, a couple of weeks shy of 27, and she lived and worked in Wichita. I was 24, roughly half a continent away, and I knew she half hated both of us for what had happened. When Amy came out, I realized I hadn't told the cab driver to pick us up, and we waited a while until the woman made the call and someone showed. They'd given her a local only, because that's what they were equipped to do. And she wasn't groggy on the ride to the border, but sat forward and gripped the edges of the front seat and didn't want to talk. The customs man checked the cab for contraband and breezed through our bags, and we were in our rented car in a matter of minutes. I drove out of Del Rio, headed east on 90. Amy slept a while and woke up and was thirsty. Up ahead of us, a pickup went into a spin, just like that. The only other vehicle on the road, skidding and whipping when it came off a sandy ramp. And I slowed down so we could watch objectively. "Swapped ends," Amy said quietly. "That's what my old granddad Parker would say. Trucks swapped ends, for sure." She spoke in a tired and quiet voice, and I drove slowly past the pickup, which was facing the way it wanted to face again, with two teenage boys in the cab, collecting themselves in a flurry of stupid grins. And I looked for a place where Amy could get a cool and healthy drink, somewhere between here and the airport. October 27th, 1962. The hotel was called the Waves, and why not? This was Ocean Drive, wasn't it, in the municipality of Miami Beach. Small, rich, angry men got out of rented convertibles with their dolled-up wives, women so cultishly tanned they resembled tobacco leaf. Spoiled, savvy, with-it kids from northern cities flashed fake IDs at the bar. They were enrolled at the resort colleges in the area and were eager to catch the act in the big room. A contingent of Cubans fell by, headed for the hotel lounge, shod, clad, tropically smart. The women in wraparound white and born to dance, and the men sunglassed and wary. They looked like bodyguards for some jefe about to topple. There was a Latin band in the lounge doing mambos and cha-chas, and a number of Long Island sexpots were here looking for second husbands. They traveled in pairs, or with a sister even, like a hunter and her gun-bearer, one divorced, one single, dating an orthodontist here and an iffy sort of businessman there. Says he's an executive in the hotel linen supply business, but when I call him on the phone, I have to ask for Marty, and his name is Fred. Eyelinered, tweezered, mascaraed, flashing acrylic nails, coral, with matching lipstick and blush. These were women who'd always been part of the in-group, and some of them preferred the nightclub to the lounge because they wanted to get a taste of Lenny Bruce. First you laugh, then you dance. The room was called El Patio, and the mambo music from the lounge kept seeping in. Lenny was surprised to spot some old people in the crowd, a few canes propped against the chairs. But he decided not to do any crippled bits. Not because he was getting cautious and soft. No, there was only one subject tonight, and it was central to his existence. We're less than 200 miles from Cuba. I know you know this, and I know this, but I still have to say it. Those missiles are just over my right shoulder, Dick. A range of 1,000 kilometers, which is redundant from our viewpoint, but which disturbs me anyway, because we haven't even lost the war yet, and we're already on the metric system. And he stood nodding his head, looking semi-jet-lagged, a little paranoid, a little over-medicated, his voice subdued, and his eyes murky with lunar gloom. And we won't get killed for being Jewish. That's the tricky part. They'll kill us for being American. How do we feel about that? What a way to begin a night of entertainment. There was a long, lugubrious silence. Then Lenny did a standing left turn, posed a moment like some discus Greek, and finally shot his upper body forward and pounded the floor with his fist. A college kid laughed. What I love are the names of our protectors. Check it out, Jim. And he took a clutch of news clips from the side pocket of the ratty car coat he was wearing, mumbled some lines of text, made a few Mort-Salish comments, dropped a clipping and kicked it, speaking briefly in his Transylvanian voice.
All right, these men are deciding our fate. They're going in and out of solemn meetings all day and night.
White shirts, cufflinks, striped ties. But their names are where it's at. Adlai Stevenson. Adlai! Gasses you right down to your capizios, right? It's so exclusive it has no gender. This little boy is so special, we don't want anyone to know he's a boy. Because ultimately, Dig, being a boy or a girl is so fucking common. And if anyone else uses this name within a 5,000-mile radius of our Adlai, we'll pay to have him killed. And all his progeny completely extinguish the line, because this is our family thing. That's it, you see? La Cosa Nostra. Only they don't have to do it with extortion and murder. They do it with names that no one else could ever think up. The divorced women laughed. There were lowlifes from the dog track in attendance, musicians on their night off, pool boys and out-of-work dancers. There were two tables of travel agents on a junket from Toronto. They thought Lenny was a Scottish comic who did impressions of the royal family. All right, Dig. Dean Rusk. Dean. Born to lead, to advise and instruct. Born to be bald. No, yes, wise, but also tough and shrewd. Look out for men with one syllable in each name. Unyielding motherfuckers. But here's my favorite, okay? You know what I'm going to say, don't you?
An old lady laughed.
That's right. McGeorge Bundy. McGeorge. How do you survive childhood with a name like that? Was his name reversed at birth? A mistake at the hospital? Of course not. They did it. They marked him for greatness. Besides, he had a grandmother named McMary.
The old lady loved it. Lenny took a while to riffle through the strips of newsprint, mumbling something.
Yes, no, here's one. Roswell Gilpatrick. Roswell. It's not a put-on. It's real. Look, shown here in the cabinet room, captured on film. The secretaries, the assistant secretaries, the undersecretaries, the deputy undersecretaries, the advisors on Russian affairs. Alexis Johnson. Alexis. Bromley Smith. Bromley. Llewellyn Thompson. Llewellyn. Four L's in Llewellyn. Takes balls, baby. Secretly, see, I have to admire him. Because they understand the logic of how to conduct yourself unsentimentally in the world. W. Averill Harriman. Averill. This is a man who has his own exit on the New York State Thruway. And here's us, a stone's throw from Cuba. They're not drawn here, but we are. Because the atomic bomb is Old Testament. It's the Jewish Bible in spades. We feel at home with this judgment, this punishment hanging over us. Illness and misfortune. Speak to us, sweetheart.
But Lenny's paranoia and sense of tragedy may have had a more immediate source. He'd been tipped off at the airport that the Dade County police had planted Jewish detectives in the audience. Yes, Yiddish-speaking fuzz, who were prepared to glom onto every vile syllable he uttered in the mother-in-law tongue.
You want names? I'll give you names. My name is Leonard Alfred Schneider. What was I doing when I took the name Lenny Bruce? I was moving toward the invisible middle. I'm just like you, mister. Don't bug me, man, or insult my ancestors. I'm just another Lenny. Just another Bruce. But that's not what the ordained people do. McGeorge, Roswell, Adlai. They remove themselves from any taint of the big middle. And that's a genius thing. Doesn't matter where they go to church, their name is their church. They're not only not like Leonard Alfred Schneider, they're not like Lenny Bruce. And I don't blame him, frankly.
He'd spoken quietly, conversationally, in his nasal slant, and didn't expect the large laugh. He put away the papers he'd been waving. The Latin music began to pound the walls, and a heckler started talking to Lenny, a drunk with a rolled-up racing form. But Lenny only lifted the mic off the stand and blessed the man. Then he did an impression of the Queen of England ordering Chinese takeout over the phone. The travel agents loved it.
If your name is Roswell or Bromley, you have a real father. Only the most responsible parents give their kids that kind of name. If you're a Roswell, you don't have a father who comes around twice a year and gives you a novelty toy when he leaves. Here, kid, a little something to deepen our relationship. You study the item. It's a rubber vomit blob. Here, kid, put it on your mother's bed.
Lenny snapped his fingers and did a shoulder curl.
So happens the Office of Civil Defense is stockpiling rubber vomit in fallout shelters all over the country. They're in a frenzy right now, man. Get those shelters built and stocked. Sanitation kits, medical kits, phenobarbital to sedate you. Penicillin, I don't know, for bomb rash. When the radiation makes you too sick to vomit, they hand out rubber vomit for morale. After the mass destruction of a nuclear exchange, he looked at his watch, they're going to want to rebuild. And all this Cold War junk is going to be worth plenty as quaint memorabilia. Those yellow and black signs you've been seeing everywhere but never really noticed until 6 days ago. Fallout shelter. Collector's items. All the stuff that's stashed in the storage rooms and laundry rooms that are designated shelters. Drums of drinking water. Saltines. Chapstick. For the flash. Cardboard toilets that double as salad bowls. Incidentally, he said. A waiter dropped a tray of drinks. The Navy boarded a ship yesterday at the quarantine line. First ship boarded. Armed boarding party. Bet your ass it was tense, baby. Turns out the ship's not carrying missiles, carrying truck parts and toilet paper. See, there it is. Ordinary life trying to reassert itself. That's the secret meaning of this week. The secret history that never appears in the written accounts of the time or in the public statements of the men in power. Those beautiful bombs and missiles, those planes and submarines. Ever see anything so gorgeous? The weapons get the best engineering and the most poetic names. Meanwhile, some old grubby farmer in Cuba is waiting for a carburetor for his beat-up tractor. And he's been wiping his ass with the lettuce crop. They're reminding him he has to be patient, yeah, while they work out their big power relationships. Lenny did a dip and swivel. You remember the way your mother talked to you when you were on the potty? Make, sweetheart, make for Mommy. He did a pivot and spin. And you cops on special duty, the linguists in the crowd, there's something you ought to know. The word smack or heroin comes from the Yiddish shmek. You know this, experts? A sniff, a smell, like a pinch of snuff. Dig it? He's got a $200 shmek habit. Next time you bust a junkie who's a co-religionist, the word gets a little barking laugh from the college kids. And you stick your rubber glove up his ass to check what kind of stash he's got in there. That smell you smell is shmek, my friend. Which is just another name for ordinary life. The detectives did not laugh. A sea breeze blew through the room, and the band was playing cha-chas now. A woman sitting down missed her chair. Dancers appeared at the far end of the bar. They were spilling out of the lounge. One, two, cha-cha-cha. And Lenny rolled his shoulders and dipped his hips. The travel agents took a vote and decided to order another round. The music drilled the wall like tamale farts, and a couple of college girls got up and danced in place among the crowded tables. The original dancers moved in a boxer's crouch, advancing down the bar in pastel skirts and white guayaberas, while test missiles in California were reprogrammed with Soviet targets. Lenny seized the mic and cried, "We're all gonna die!" They laughed and half wept. He led them in a chorus of the chant. The cha-cha music poured into the room, and the dancers followed in beautifully balanced twos, and the men and women at the tables got up and danced in place, making pugilistic motions with their hands. One, two, cha-cha-cha. They kicked off their shoes and spilled their drinks. Lenny did a monologue in Spanglish, and they loved it, and laughed, and half-wept. And a young man majoring in wardrobe management chug-a-lugged a glass of straight scotch, a stone's throw from Cuba. It's fabulous. It's marvelous. It's Miami. Chapter 6 October 18th, 1967. Marion Bowman was talking to her mother. They were in the living room of her mother's house, her mother and father's house, where she'd grown up. And there were sprays of baby's breath in most of the rooms and in bud vases on hall tables, small white flowers in branched clusters. A plant her mother liked to display in its starkness, free of the customary larger arrangement. For whatever reason a mother might have, with the elms going yellow and the red oaks blazing on a fine fall day in Madison, Wisconsin, and students running wild in the streets.
"So you've been keeping secrets?"
"He's not a secret," Marion said. "You've known him all this time, and I'm only now hearing? That's a secret."
"I've known him technically all this time."
"And now you know him how?" The mother smiled first, then the daughter.
"Untechnically," Marion said. "And he's not a secret. There hasn't been much to say, that's all."
"There's always something to say."
What do I sense about this relationship? I think you're very uncertain. You have a tendency, you always did, to act against your misgivings. Because, well, I don't know why you do it exactly. They heard the voices more clearly now, ripping from stereo speakers set in the windows of A-frames along Mifflin Street.
I wasn't aware. Have I expressed misgivings?
Yes. And it's clear I meant to notice. And it's clear you want me to argue against the man.
This is totally... No.
Marion said mildly. You can't bring yourself to argue against him. You want me to do it.
And you sense all this, sort of.
Not sort of. Hard and clear.
And what happens when you argue against him? Do I say, thank you, Mother, you've saved me from a fate worse?
Of course not. You defend him. You stand up for him.
She stands up for her man. And you what? You infer all this from a little bitty talk in which I said practically nothing about him?
Tell me I'm wrong, her mother said, and I'll make every effort to believe you. Her mother turned toward the window, showing a faint annoyance. They were running in the streets. They were probably throwing bricks and starting fires. There was a bullhorn voice mixed in with the music that ripped from the speakers. They have what they call the riot season.
Did it ever occur to me, Marion said, that Chicago would seem peaceful and decent?
I don't know if this is the riot season or not. Maybe it's just a block party that the police are trying to contain. Although, no, that can't be right. They have block parties in the spring.
I'll come back for Thanksgiving if you'll make them stop that noise.
Her mother said, Is he married?
And instantly regretted it.
Marion saw the self-reproach in the tilt of her mother's mouth. Yes, a rare lapse. It diminished the authority of her earlier remarks and was totally unthought out. A lapse, a tactical mistake. And the color in her mother's face went flat. Because if he were married, one, why would Marion talk about him without saying so? And two, why would she talk about him at all?
No, of course not.
Of course not, I know that, her mother said. Marion went upstairs feeling better. She loved her old room. She loved coming back because the quiet streets were here, in theory, and the houses with screened sun porches, and the elmed esplanades and university buildings, and because her room was here, kept safe for her, spare, unspecial, unfussed over, but a place no one could see as she did, containing a sizable measure of what is meant by home. She started packing for the trip back, taking some winter things out of the closet, and then stopped just long enough to turn on the radio. She found WIBA, Up Against the Wall FM, because she wanted to know what was going on out there, just as a point of exasperated interest, and because the noise was getting louder. It was too soon to pack, but she did it anyway. Home is the place where they have to take you in, said the poet, or said Marion's father, paraphrasing the poet. And home is also the place you can't wait to get the hell out of. She had a job in Chicago she hated. Only she didn't really hate it. She'd acquired gestures of discontent because this seemed to be a thing you were supposed to do. She was 25 and saw no future doing backroom work in a brokerage house. But the job was okay, in a way, because it forced her to be disciplined and involved and unsloppy. And anyway, there was nothing else she wanted to try just now.
The radio said, Dow Day, Dow Day, Dow Day, Dow Day.
She rummaged through the dresser, finding a couple of old sweaters that might be passable still, and a number of bright stocking caps that were funny and dumb. The dresser was the one object in the room worth a second look outside the text of personal reference. An oak piece fitted with a tall, scuffed mirror that was hinged to swivels in a graceful trefoil frame.
The radio said, Pig, 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 pig.
She began to understand that some of the noise in the streets, the music and voices ripping from speakers that students had placed in their windows, was coming from the station she was tuned to. She packed and listened. The radio said,
Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. She began to understand that this was Vietnam Week on campuses across the country. And this was Dow Day here in Madison, a protest against Dow Chemical, whose recruiters were active on campus and whose products included a new and improved form of napalm with a polystyrene additive that made jellied matter cling more firmly to human flesh. Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. She thought, small wonder, because it sounded as if the students were tearing up the campus. And it looked as if, earlier in the day, with Viet Cong flags on Linden Street and mimes in whiteface tussling with police on Bascom Hill, it looked as if what? The station was reporting Dow Day and seemingly taking part. The radio said, "Pig, pig, 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 pig." It looked as if something had happened in the night to change the rules of what is thinkable. She began to understand that the riot out there, if that's what it was being augmented and improved by a simulated riot on the radio. An audio montage of gunfire, screams, sirens, klaxons, and intermittent bulletins, real and possibly not. She found the old coat she thought she'd lost. "How do you lose a coat?" everybody said. 5 years ago at the lake. The radio said, "Take your belt and wrap it around your fist." When her mother served pork loin last night, her father muttered, "Off the pig." And somehow it wasn't meant to be funny, although when Marion laughed, he did too, a little bitterly. The radio said, "There's an info bulletin coming up." She was supposed to go to school at night, but wasn't, to learn stocks, bonds, debentures, and other instruments of material wealth available for the production of more wealth, but wasn't because she just wasn't, but would, and soon, knowing what she knew, that she needed outside forces to counteract her tendencies. She wanted to call Nick, but knew he wouldn't be there. The radio played recorded gunfire, car crashes, lines of gritty dialogue from old war movies. Her mother called her remiss and indifferent. She suffered from disambition, said her mother. Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. She listened to this because it was happening here, but she also tuned out intermittently, let her attention wander as a form of self-defense. There was a kind of tiredness to it all. It had that wearying insistence that made her want to tune out. She packed and thought of calling, even though he wasn't there, to leave a message with someone in the school office, clever and sexy, and he wouldn't like that at all, but she thought she might do it anyway. Anfo seemed to be an acronym for ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. She put the sweaters back on the dresser. She'd pick them up at Thanksgiving, if she thought she needed them, and if she didn't change her mind about their passability, which she was in the process of doing. The radio said, "Kafka without the F is caca." "Yes, we are talking about waste. We are talking about fertilizer. We are talking about waste and weapons. We are talking about ANFO, the bomb that begins in the asshole of a barnyard pig." "Pig, pig, 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 pig." She dug a pack of cigarettes out of a pocket in the suitcase. Then she opened a window and lit one up. The noise came blowing in. Bullhorn cops, news bulletins, rock music. And she turned off the radio and sat by the window, smoking. She'd seen a multicolored Volkswagen Beetle with painted faces in the windows earlier in the day on Babcock Drive. She sat there, blowing smoke out the window, because her mother was supposedly allergic and would have preferred, in any case, that Marion did not smoke. And they were taking off their belts and wrapping them around their fists. And a Dow recruiter was trapped in Commerce Hall, listening to firecrackers, if that's what they were, going off outside the door to room 104, where he talked across the desk to a potential recruit. there were trash fires on Lower State Street. There were rumors about Terminal Theater, a group that did not concede its own existence. And a student on a second-story porch on Mifflin Street turned up the volume when she saw police in riot gear moving in a double column down the street. And over by the library mall, members of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, if that's who they were, kept turning up among the police, more or less suicidally, wearing white face and carrying panpipes and dressed in busker costume, quaint and ill-fitting mid-Victorian drag, with cricket caps. A dozen young men and women on the police side of the skirmish line mimicking the gestures of the cops and getting dragged to a van and beaten. People everywhere listened to the radio, to the dialogue between what was real and what was spliced and mixed and processed and played. And the speakers dealt out heavy metal, and a woman on the air read the copy on package inserts of Dow products, speaking in a hushed and sexy voice. The police began firing tear gas, and students started running toward the gas out of a sort of rompish curiosity, or because the gas carried a fragrance of apple blossoms, believe it or not, a fast-acting agent now being used in Vietnam. Common sense, uncommon chemistry. This was Dow's catchy ad slogan, and the woman read it on the air repeatedly in a soft and sexy voice. There were Dow interviews scheduled in three buildings, but the sit-in was taking place at Commerce, and that's where the recruiter sat trapped, with a hamburger going cold in a white bag. Two squads of police formed a wedge. He said to the potential recruit, "So tell me about what happens between now and graduation day." The kid said, "Someone had a live rat out there." "Let's, I think, stick to the issue," the recruiter said, "for our own, really, peace of mind." Or they ran toward the gas because they thought the moral force of their argument would neutralize the effect of the chemicals. The San Francisco Mime Troupe was not supposed to be on the library mall. This was the interesting thing. And affinity groups started fires here and there, or broke windows. Small bands with names like the Mudville Nine, the members masked in bandanas soaked in baking soda and egg white, a folk remedy against the gas. And smoke and white streamers rose from projectiles that came flopping down on the broad lawn in front of Bascom Hall. Students were running the other way now, moving in an agitated mass, some with Dixie cups over their mouths or hankies out, and others strolled casually on the sidewalk between the squads of helmeted police and the thickening gas, which was beginning to roll in banks toward the columned hall. And a guy resting a guitar lengthwise on his head stood watching from the streetlight. And the sexy voice on the radio repeated the DuPont slogan now, "Better things for better living through chemistry." The woman enjoyed the pause. She prolonged the pause. She moaned through the pause. She spoke urgently and excitedly up to the pause, and then she paused and moaned slowly. And then she finished reciting the slogan, finally, all sated and limp and moaned out, and then she started from the beginning again. The San Francisco Mime Troupe was supposed to be in front of Old Chemistry. This was the interesting thing. They were supposed to be passing out copies of Faculty Document 122 in front of Old Chemistry, which is exactly where they were. Chanting Faculty Document 122 authorizes force against students. This was interesting because it meant that the people in whiteface on the library mall must be members of Terminal Theater, the legendary factoidal group whose name, even, was subject to conjecture, or was an aspect, perhaps, of the group's borderline existence. Rock and roll everywhere. Serpentine twangs of feedback rolling from window speakers all over the campus and on nearby streets. The police were coming down hard now, clubs out, cops acting without orders, or against orders, inevitably, riding their own rampant highs. The recruiter and the student waited to be rescued, and they talked in the meantime about courses and professors as an affinity group entered the building with cherry bombs, lengths of pipe, and size D flashlight batteries, the homemade makings of a mortar attack. The radio reported that Lyndon Johnson was being dangled upside down from a tow line on a helicopter, swinging in the breeze over the primate lab, right here in Madison, in the outright nude, after being kidnapped by parties unknown. The radio reported that you could make your own napalm by mixing one part liquid detergent Joy with two parts benzene or one part gasoline. Shake vigorously. The Dayglow VW moved through the streets, and Marion shut the window and turned on the radio, and then went and flushed the cigarette down the toilet. She began to understand that someone or some group had taken over the radio. And as the day waned, a man recited instructions for the manufacture of a fertilizer bomb. How to buy the nitrate cheap. It comes bagged, or bulk, from a farm supply store. And how to add the fuel oil, and what to do to ignite the mix. There was an interval of static and a brief silence. Then the radio returned to its normal broadcast mode. What was this? Three voices chanting liturgically, a priest reciting the same line over and over, and two altar boys delivering fixed responses. Better things for better living, through chemistry. Better things for better living, through chemistry. Better things for better living, through chemistry. She turned off the radio. Then her father came home and was filled in by her mother. And they all sat down to dinner with the poached bass and the baby's breath, and her father said, "What is he?" Marion thought this was funny, and maybe her father did, too, a little. What could she say? She could say what he wasn't. This would take a fair amount of time. But concerning what he was, well, she could say he was an English teacher in a secondary school in Arizona. But she couldn't say a whole lot more, because there wasn't much he'd told her. Her mother talked about the broken bones of the demonstrators, the students with head wounds, clubbed, gassed, bleeding. Her father said, "Do you know what this means to me, the injuries of the students? What can I compare it with? Because I want to be fair to them. It's like the life and death of a fly on a wall in a village somewhere in China. That's how much I care." He had a drained smile that no one liked to see. "I guess that means you can't be a Buddhist, because the Buddhists, if I understand them correctly," her mother said, and then let the thought drift toward the ceiling. Marion sat in her room that night and dialed Nick's number. She told him about her day. There wasn't much to tell him because she left out the demonstration. She was feeling needy, moody, and lunar, and she didn't want distractions. Then she told him she wanted to get married. She wanted to marry him and live with him anywhere, wherever he wanted, and not have kids, and not have friends, and never go to dinner with her parents. There was a silence at the other end that she couldn't read. A telephone silence can be hard to read, grim and deep, and sometimes unsettling. You don't have the softening aspect of the eyes or even the look-away glance while he ponders. There's nothing in the silence but the deep distance between you. They finished the conversation in a halting and awkward manner, and she was damn mad, angry at him and at herself. Mostly herself, she decided. And she was determined to get back to the grind, to the work of hygiened perfection, shaping herself, willing herself into tighter being. She opened the window and lit a cigarette and sat there blowing streams of smoke into the cool night air. February 6th, 1953. His mother didn't want him playing cards on the corner, even with Catholic schoolboys, and she waited until he came upstairs and told him. He played a game called Setemets, for pennies, sitting on the one-step terrace outside the grocery store, freezing on the stone, and he memorized the cards coming out of the dealer's hand and won very regular, expecting a picture card, and it would come, worth half a point. But she told him not to play anymore. But before she told him this, he sat there in the cold, memorizing the cards and making his bets. When he got 7.5, which was the best score you could get, he turned over his hold card and said, "Sette mets." But when the dark seeped down around the players, he had to quit the game and go to the butcher to pick up the meat his mother had bought earlier in the day. The butcher was nicer to him now, with Nick upstate. The butcher asked him if he was old enough to get it up, and Matty said 13, almost, and the butcher said, "Salud." The butcher said he needed someone to tell him what it was like to get it up, because he couldn't remember anymore. And this was the same thing the butcher used to say to Nick, more or less, when Nick was the one who went for the meat. And Matty felt good about this, smelling sawdust and blood. When he was walking home with the meat, a woman came out of the bread store and gave Matty a tweak with her fingers, a twist of the flesh on his cheek, affectionate, like turning a key, and she told him to give regards to his mother. He reached his street, and the kids were still playing cards in front of the grocery, in the dark. Some of the same kids who used to taunt him for his chess when he played chess, or because he had no father. And he sat in for a couple of hands, figuring the meat could not go bad in the freezing cold, and he memorized the cards as they fell. Then he went upstairs, and she told him she didn't want him gambling. She told him even if it was only pennies. She said it didn't look good, and led to other things and other kinds of company. And she told him she didn't want to say anything in front of the other boys, whether they were Catholic school boys or not. And he stood there with the meat in his arms. They were the two of them alone, and he wanted to obey. He felt the solemn weight of the situation, the size of Nicky's going. But there were always kids playing cards on the stoops and corners, and he wasn't sure, when they dealt him in, that he'd say no. And not because he could memorize the cards. It wasn't so sneaky as that. It was another kind of thing completely. He was a little bit of a hero with his brother upstate, doing what he'd done. And boys from blocks around wanted to know him. This is why he thought it might be hard to obey her, with the lamb chops knobby in his arms. December 1st, 1969. You can't fight a war without acronyms. This is a fact of modern combat, according to Lewis T. Bakey. And where do these compressed words come from? They come from remote levels of development, from technicians and bombheads in their computer universe, storky, bespectacled men who deal with systems so layered and many connected that the ensuing arrays of words must be atomized and redesigned, made spare and letters sleek. But acronyms also come from the ranks, don't they? At least occasionally. Look at old Lewis, strapped and cramped in his aft-facing ejection seat in the lower deck of the forward fuselage, going through the checklist. And the crews in alert barracks worldwide, waiting for the klaxons to sound. And the guys on the line who load the ordnance and juice the engines. These are men who feel an armpit intimacy with the weapon systems they maintain and fly. This gives their acronyms a certain funky something. And this is why the high-altitude bombers sitting on the ramp out there, crew of six, including Lewis, a great, massive, swept-wing and soon-to-soar B-52. This aircraft is known as a buff to tens of thousands of men throughout the command. For big, ugly, fat fuck. In the cockpit, the pilot and co-pilot hacked their watches for the second time. The crewmen at their separate stations went through the standard 100-headed procedure. The gunner floating alone in the tail turret at the end of a crawlway. The EW officer shoehorned into a cubicle at the rear of the upper deck. And down in the squat black hole, Lewis Bakey let a yawn come rolling out and looked at the panels, switches, and monitors that encased him in a more or less total monopoly of avionic jargon. And he half-nudged the navigator pressed in next to him.
"Chuckman, I find myself in a very pussy-minded mood today."
"Hell of a time to be thinking such thoughts."
"I don't think no thoughts. They just come." being we're strapped in this tube for the next... That's the fucked up beauty of the thing. How thoughts just come, oven by themselves.
Not counting debrief, 12 hours, Lewisman.
In other words, you're saying, hold that thought. Hold that thought, Lewis said. Put it on the back burner.
Exactly.
First we bomb them,
then we fuck them, said the navigator. Whatever the bluntness of the acronym, there was nothing ugly about the nose art that adorned the area of the fuselage just aft of the cockpit windows. A tall, young, leggy blonde, a cheerleader type in a skimpy skirt and halter, with hands on hips and feet apart, and a dare-me look on her face. She wants to be sexy, but isn't sure she knows how. Very girl-next-doorish. And her name painted in script just above the line of mission symbols that numbered 38. Long, tall Sally. The pilot taxied to the runway, and the tower cleared the plane for takeoff. The co-pilot said, 5, 4, 3. The pilot had the throttles gang-barred to full-on position. The co-pilot said, 1, 0, rolling. When the plane rumbled past marker 7 for 7,000 feet of runway, the co-pilot said, speaking with a sense of enormous buffeted mass that caused his teeth to feel uprooted, because this is nearly 500,000 pounds of big, ugly, fat fuckness laboring to lift itself over the marsh grass. The co-pilot said, committed. And then the dark body began to loom like some apparition of the mists. Long wings bending, and flaps extended, and wheels breaking contact, and then the gear coming up, and the smoky spews of trailing black alcohol, and the storm roar shaking the flats. In the hole, the navigator, Charles Wainwright Jr., called Chucky, continued to scan the skatey 8 meters and switches and disconnects, a whole lifetime of indicators clustered in front of him and above him and to one side, the side not occupied by Lewis Bakey, the radar bombardier. Chucky scanned the switches and harassed his buddy, encouraging marriage to a decent woman with church affiliations.
Don't start in with me, Lewis said. I don't need a wife. I don't need a church. You're the one who needs these things.
I already, Lewis, have had a wife.
Who you didn't appreciate mentally.
I had to go through my awkward phase. I was finishing out some things, Chucky said. The two men had been crewmates since Greenland, flying through Arctic mirages and 50-knot gales. Their current bombing runs were strangely uneventful by comparison, or a different level of reality at any rate, easier to project as a movie.
I know what you need, Lewis said. A woman who'll be willing to accept your history as screw-ups. You need to unload this stuff on someone who's innocent. You want a sweet young female who was born to understand you, like the sweet thing on the nose of this aircraft.
Lewis said sweet thing in a scornful black voice. Since Lewis was a scornful black, this was not surprising.
Sweet thing.
Not that he didn't have a spiritual side that Chucky responded to. You only had to listen to his stories of the early A-tests over Nevada. Stories he'd told dozens of times through the years in lonely barracks in Greenland, Goose Bay, and a number of remote SAC bases in the continental United States.
I don't think you ought to deride. Deride? That's nice, Lewis said. I'd rather deride her than ride her, tell you the truth. I believe she's too skinny for my taste. Plus, she's been misnamed.
What's that supposed to mean?
I get so tired educating these boys.
What's it mean, Lewis, misnamed?
Long, tall Sally.
From the song of the same title.
At least he knows that much. Heavens above. You think I don't know Little Richard and his ow, wow, wow, wow? This boy worth saving, Lewis said. But the point being...
Used to hide his records from my parents.
Oh, baby, woo, baby.
I was 13 years old.
This old Negro is touched, Chuck, man. But the point I'm making is that the long, tall Sally in the song and the long, tall Sally they painted on our nose are not one and the same female of the species. Why not? Check her out. She's long, she's tall, she's got great legs, and she looks to me like her name could be Sally. Woo! We're going to have some fun tonight. Going to have some fun tonight. That's exactly right, Lewis said. Only the Sally and Little Rich's number ain't going to be seen in no car and no drive-in movie doing a little necking with a youth like yourself. Why not? Chucky said. Because she black, and she bad.
Chucky studied his radar scope and recomputed the aircraft's path over a couple thousand miles of sea curve and Mango Atoll.
What do you mean, she black? Because the song has a plot that somehow got lost in the wooing and wheeing. The song's been around 13, 14, 15 years, maybe? More or less, Lewis said. And in all these years, I'm not aware of anybody coming forth with a correction to the skin color of the title character, okay?
On the intercom, the pilot said conversationally, I wonder if that's Manila down there. She looks pretty, Nav. This was an unfunny dig at the windowless pair in the lower deck, who not only lacked a skyscape, but sat facing backwards. And not only sat facing backwards, but would be forced to eject downwards if nicked by an enemy Sam. Another sinister acronym designed to kill.
Pilot, this is Nav, Chucky said.
And he fine-tuned his scope and requested a minimal turn, aligning the plane's actual path with the track he'd plotted earlier. Then he said,
Lewis, this girl out there is good luck for us. Nearly 40 missions without a major incident. Don't abuse her goodwill. She's long, tall Sally, the one and only.
When Lewis became agitated, he used a staccato patter, a kind of hyper-drawl with elements of falsetto peak that he strung throughout at a master pitch.
Song say, you have any idea what the song say? This woman in an alley. Old Uncle John in the alley with her. She built for speed. She got everything he need. Yes, baby, woo, baby, gonna have some fun tonight.
This ends Disc 20.